Welcome to Research and Review. Most of us will have had a course of antibiotics at some point in our lives. However, the medicines that we use today are at risk of becoming ineffective due to the emergence of antimicrobial resistance. Today we discuss a study of the antibiotic colistin and how understanding how it kills bacteria can help improve its efficacy and patient outcomes. Our guest today studies how antibiotics kill bacteria and researches how we can make them more effective through novel approaches. He is currently a senior lecturer in the Department of Infectious Diseases at Imperial College London. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Andrew Edwards.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much for joining us today. So over the past few years, we've heard more about the increasing resistance of pathogens to antibiotics. So could you tell us a bit about how big of a threat is antimicrobial resistance to global health?
Well, most of the people listening to this podcast will have had at least one course of antibiotics at some point in their life. And usually it'll be for something minor, but the point is that it stops that minor infection becoming serious. But antibiotics are really important for enabling lots of advances in modern medicine. So if you think about surgery, lots of surgical approaches wouldn't be possible without antibiotics because the risk of infection is too great. Antibiotics are also really important for the success of cancer chemotherapy, organ transplantation, survival of trauma, survival of preterm infants, people with diabetes, and so on. And so antibiotics have really enabled a lot of advances in modern medicine. So if they start to become significantly less effective, then it's going to be a really, really big problem. And I should say it's part of the problem isn't just the emergence of resistance, but there is a corresponding lack of development of new antibiotics as well. So it's sort of a double-edged sword, and both of those edges are very sharp and very, very threatening.
So antimicrobial resistance was identified, you know, sort of 1930s, 1940s. So we've known about it for quite a long time. So why is it now becoming a really big problem?
So most of the antibiotics in use today were discovered between sort of 1940s through to 1960s. And although, as you rightly say, resistance was recognized, there were so many different antibiotics that it wasn't really perceived to be a major threat. But what's happened sort of in the last 30, 40 years is that the prevalence of resistance has increased, and not just resistance to one or two antibiotics, but resistance to multiple different types of drugs. And that combined with the fact that we don't have very many new drugs means that we're starting to reach a tipping point. And there are increasing numbers of infections caused by bacteria that are resistant to pretty much everything we have available.
So how come no new antibiotics have been found recently? Is it because there isn't thought to be a demand for them, or is it just very hard to find these molecules?
So there are, as with all drug development, there are, you know, significant technical challenges and lots of hurdles and so on. But one of the biggest barriers is financial. So if we think about most new, you know, medicines, as soon as they're ready, they'll be licensed and they'll be used in as many people as possible. But with antibiotics, because the more you use them, the less effective they become, new antibiotics are kept in reserve to treat only infections caused by the most drug-resistant bacteria. And that means there isn't much of a market for them. And so the financial returns on antibiotics are really, really poor, especially if you compare them to, say, drugs used to treat chronic conditions, things like depression, diabetes, high blood pressure, and so on. The sales of new antibiotics are really poor. And so lots of companies that were interested have either gone bust or they've withdrawn from working in this area. And there's a really good report for those who are interested, a really good report from the Wellcome Trust on exactly this area. So to address that, we need, you know, new financial models just for antibiotics. So financial returns are sort of guaranteed to companies that make antibiotics, but the drugs aren't sort of used in everyone, you don't have to guarantee sales. And I have to say, the UK government have actually led the way on some of these initiatives. There's a lot of work to be done, but one thing I can praise the UK government for is leading on this issue.
Fantastic. And that kind of ties into something in a previous podcast. The fourth episode was with Professor Kevin Reid from Dundee's Drug Discovery Unit, and he spoke about sort of the current model of treating neglected tropical diseases, where a lot of it had to be done starting in academia before the drug companies would take it on. Do you think that in the future, in order to make, you know, new antibiotics some like financially a financial incentive for them, that it's going to be most of the research is mostly going to have to be focused in academia?
I think at the moment, yeah, a lot of the research is focused in academia, and part of the issue is that academia can only take things so far. And I think part of this issue is around, as an academic, understanding what industry are looking for, because I think academics tend to like quite clever solutions. An industry prefers something a bit more straightforward, robust, broad spectrum that they can sort of, you know, produce in large quantities and get through all of the regulatory hurdles that exist.
Absolutely. And as one of these academics who is studying antimicrobial resistance, what first got you interested in the field?
So I'm of an age now where, when I was doing my A-levels, I was always interested in biology and medical science. And I was looking at what the big challenges are. And of course, you know, there's things like cancer and diabetes and things like that. But I was really interested in sort of emerging threats like drug-resistant TB and MRSA and things that were sort of perceived to have been fixed and solved and had gone away and were now coming back. And so I studied microbiology at University College London. And then did a PhD. And I think just from there, I've been really interested in understanding how bacteria cause disease and how we can stop that. So I've spent a bit of time working on vaccines, but there are lots of diseases and lots of infections for which we don't have effective vaccines. And antibiotics are an area that I think there's a need. And they combine my interests of, I'm really interested in fundamental molecular sort of biology, but I also like having that sort of small, slight translational element. And I, by working in this area, I get to tick both those boxes. I also get to work with lots and lots of other people. I do work with, for example, with people at Dundee Drug Discovery Unit, but we also work with chemists here and people in bioengineering and some of the clinical bacteriologists. It allows me to work with lots and lots of other interesting and bright people, which is fantastic.
Absolutely. And that's really interesting because So moving on to the actual paper itself. So today we're discussing a study you're involved in about colistin and its mechanisms of action. And you said in the paper that it's one of these antibiotics of last resort that you were mentioning earlier. So what makes colistin antibiotic of last resort, and how is it different from something a bit more general, like, let's say, penicillin?
Okay, so starting with penicillin. So penicillin is what's known as a beta-lactam antibiotic, and beta-lactams are generally very, very good drugs. They're safe. Unless you've got an allergy, they're very safe. They're not, you know, they're generally very effective, and they're the most commonly used type of antibiotic. But unfortunately, lots of bacteria acquire resistance to beta-lactams. They acquire enzymes that chew them up. And so what happens is that if you have a bacterium that's resistant to a beta-lactam, you'll either go to a newer beta-lactam or you'll use a different drug. But what we're seeing increasingly are bacteria that are resistant to pretty much everything. But the one thing that they're often still susceptible to is colistin. And that's not because colistin's a very good drug. Actually, colistin's pretty awful. And because it's awful, it hasn't really been used very much over the years. It has been used as a feed additive in agriculture, but until recently, it wasn't used in humans very much at all. it doesn't work very well in people. It is quite toxic. It has to be given intravenously. So it's not really very, very good. But it does mean that resistance to that drug is relatively rare. And so it is sort of a last resort for people who have infections caused by bacteria that are resistant to everything else.
So it's not so much that colistin is like an amazing drug. It's just the last resort ones tend to be kind of the worst ones, but because they're used the least often, that makes them somewhat more effective. And as you said in this paper, that even though colistin is a last resort, there's still resistance to it. And this resistance is heard by MCR1. So how does MCR1 confer resistance?
So when with resistance, there are a few different mechanisms that exist. And I mentioned enzymes that chew up antibiotics. Another common mechanism is typically bacteria will either acquire a mutation or they'll acquire a gene. And what that gene does is make a protein that modifies the target of the antibiotic. So antibiotics sort of engage their targets. It's a little bit like putting a key in a lock and then breaking the key. You know, the lock can no longer be accessed and opened. And so what MCR1 does is to change the chemical structure of something called lipopolysaccharide that's on the outer layer of gram-negative bacteria. So things like E. coli and Pseudomonas. MCR1 encodes an enzyme that chemically changes the LPS so that colistin doesn't bind to it so well. But what we found is that there are ways of getting around this. So not all of the LPS is changed in the outer layer. And what colistin does is it binds to the LPS, and it sort of, LPS normally forms a really tight layer that's a potent sort of barrier to antibiotics. But what colistin does is sort of just open things up a little bit, just teases the LPS apart, and that can let other antibiotics get in. So even though colistin can no longer kill the bug, it can make a sort of a little doorway for other antibiotics to get in. And so if you use drugs in combination, sometimes, you know, you can get around these resistance mechanisms.
So to go into the paper's results, the first couple of results that you got was that that MCR1 protects the cytoplasmic membrane, and that colistin targets the lipopolysaccharides in the cytoplasmic membrane. Were you surprised that it was the cytoplasmic membrane, or did you expect that going into it?
So we, as a lab, we haven't done a lot of work on gram negatives until recently, and we came into this area a little bit naively. And I think something that struck us is that it wasn't really understood how colistin killed bacteria. It was known that colistin binds to LPS and disrupts the outer membrane, but then the rest of the story was really unclear. And I think what we were trying to do with the resistance was not just understand resistance, but also to try and use resistance to understand the mechanism of the antibiotic. And I have to say, in answer to your question, were we surprised? Yes, we were. We weren't expecting that at all, because it went very much against the prevailing wisdom, which is, you know, nice. But if you get something unexpected, you should always check that it's not because you've just messed something up. The other thing is that going against sort of dogma can be challenging, and not everyone is sort of welcoming, especially if you've not worked in that field before. So the fact that MCR protected the cytoplasmic membrane was interesting from a resistance point of view, but it also told us a bit about how the antibiotic itself worked. And that was good from sort of a fundamental biology point of view, but also from a therapeutic point of view as well. So yeah, we were surprised. I'll be honest, it took a little while to figure out what was going on. And the graduate student involved in the work, Akshay, he was the one who initially came up with an idea for how things might be working. So credit to him. And then we thought about how we would test that. And we did some other experiments to test our hypothesis, because as much as we liked the idea that we, you know, made a novel finding, you do have to make sure that it's not just wishful thinking. You have to be quite strict with yourself and try and prove yourself wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah, and one thing, a final worth mentioning was one of the techniques that I want to highlight that you used was something called MALDI TOF. Describe a bit about what it is and why you chose that.
Spectroscopy is a really, really powerful tool for chemical analysis, and it's been used a lot with proteins, protein identification particularly, and it's really, really powerful for identifying proteins or even whole bacteria. It's used a lot in diagnostic bacteriology. But something that's a bit trickier is working with lipids. We know lipids are important. They form membranes, bacteria, they form membranes in humans, but lipids are quite hard to analyze. And so we worked with someone based here at Imperial, Gerald Larry-Mamous, who has really perfected the analysis of lipopolysaccharide by mass spectroscopy. And so he was able to use that to look at the chemical modifications that confer colistin resistance, but he can also use it to look at other changes in the molecule to understand a bit about the biology of the cell. And that's quite interesting because something you can do with bacteriology is you can study things directly, but what you can also do is listen to what the bacteria is telling you. And so with, for example, the membrane, if the membrane's a bit disrupted, the bacterium tries to fix it. It tries to make things go back to normal. And so it starts to change the LPS itself. It makes certain chemical modifications. And you can look for those with mass spectroscopy. And that allows you to essentially listen to what the bacterium is telling you about what's going on in the cell. And so that's quite a useful approach. So, you know, you mentioned a little while ago about how important it is to work across different disciplines and with different people. And I think working with Gerard definitely helped us with that aspect of the work. And we also had some other collaborators on that paper that helped us tackle this from other angles. So, you know, whilst it's me talking to you about this work, I think it's important to sort of underline that and say that this was very much a team effort.
We'll be moving on to opinion is the most exciting part of the paper, is where you discuss about using muiripavidin in jointly with colistin to improve efficacy. So what did you so could you describe what muiripavidin is and why did you think it would make bacteria more susceptible to colistin?
So yeah, muiripavidin is an antibiotic that is in development by a Swiss pharmaceutical company at the moment. And it's a peptide that binds to the LPS transport mechanism, and it stops LPS getting to the outer membrane. And it's in trials at the moment as an inhaled treatment for Pseudomonas lung infections, things like cystic fibrosis and bronchiectasis. So this was perfect for what we were doing, because as I mentioned, we were working in part with Pseudomonas, and Pseudomonas is targeted with colistin, and maybe in the future it'll be targeted with this other drug, both in inhaled forms. So clinically that fit together. But also from a biological standpoint, it was really nice because I mentioned to you earlier that we use spheroplasts as an experimental system, but we wanted to show that what we found applied to whole bacterial cells. And what we thought was, since colistin was targeting LPS in the cytoplasmic membrane, if we used muiripavidin, that would stop the LPS being transported to the outer membrane. So there'll be more LPS in the cytoplasmic membrane. There are more targets. So if we were right, the cells would become more susceptible to colistin. So this was a clinically relevant experiment. There was a potential therapeutic angle, but it also allowed us to test our hypothesis using whole bacterial cells. So it was sort of killing two birds with one stone. And I'm really pleased to say that our hypothesis was, you know, supported by this. When we added concentrations of muiripavidin or colistin on their own that had no effect on bacterial growth, nothing happened. But when you put those two together, there was really, really high levels of bacterial killing. And so, you know, not only did it help us test our hypothesis, but it also showed the way forward to a clinically feasible therapeutic approach as well. So we were pretty pleased with that.
Absolutely. And Is there like a precedent to this? Has there been sort of a history of using two antibiotics jointly on bacteria, or is it still very much like a new idea of doing that?
So it's interesting. So, you know, if we think about HIV, combination therapy is common. And combination therapy is also common for treating TB. Typically, it's a four-drug regimen. But it's not been used routinely to treat other bacterial infections. Sometimes, if people are really sick, they'll be put on several different drugs just to cover lots of different possible pathogens. But combination therapy is only just starting to be considered seriously. And we know that certain drugs work well together, at least in the lab, and we know that certain drugs don't work well together in the lab. But translating that into people is quite difficult. So there's a lot of interest in using colistin in combination because, as I mentioned earlier, it opens up the outer membrane and lets other drugs in. So there's interest in that. The challenge is that when you use two drugs together, you increase the likelihood of there being damage to the host. There's an increased likelihood of toxicity or interactions with the other drugs that people are on. So there's increasing interest in it, but there's a lot of work to be done, particularly clinically. We know a lot of combinations that work well in the lab, but getting them to work well in people is difficult. People are a lot more complex than the lab environment.
Absolutely. So to kind of sort of bring the paper and sort of to a close, leading on from what we just discussed, do you, even though there's still a lot of work to go, do you see it's more likely for joint therapies to become the norm as opposed to more antibiotics being discovered and explored?
I think, you know, look, the way we do things here is that we are trying to develop new antibiotics and other groups are doing the same. But there's also a recognition that that's a long process. It's, if we're honest, unlikely to succeed. Most drug projects fail. So we need to also think about how to use our current drugs better. And there is a sort of growing awareness that certain combinations can help us get around drug resistance. So my feeling is that we can sort of find ways to make our existing arsenal of antibiotics work better. And we should definitely be doing that because we don't have a lot of time to really to do that work. And that will hopefully buy us a bit of time to develop new antibiotics and other approaches as well. So I think we can do a lot more with what we've got. And I think also we're starting to see hopefully the financial incentives in place to develop a significant number of new antibiotics as well.
Absolutely. And so one contributing factor to AMR that's probably quite often spoken about is sort of the use of antibiotics sort of in agriculture and livestock. So from the findings that your lab produced, where's the next direction that you'll be going in?
Yeah, so I think we made a step forward with that work, and I think it was quite an important step forward. But there's still lots we don't understand about the mechanism. And I think what that paper shows is that understanding the very basics of how antibiotics work enables you to identify ways of making them work better. And there are variants of polymyxin, of colistin and other polymyxin antibiotics in development. So I think understanding the mechanism in more detail is definitely something we want to do. There are variations of colistin resistance, known as heteroresistance, that we don't understand very much about. And we're interested in how that occurs and how we can diagnose that better. And then I think really trying to develop better drug combinations. And this is to an extent, you know, where you have to pass the baton on, because we're not a clinical lab. I think we have to sort of take the work so far, and then hopefully other groups will progress that towards, you know, towards patients where appropriate.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining us to discuss your fascinating paper, and I hope best of luck with your future research.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.